Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Dealing with a layoff. How do you navigate your finances during a time when you're already stressed out? Credit Canada counselor Randolph Taylor is here to talk about some tips on handling your money during a period of unemployment. Hopefully it will be a short one. Then, want to invest but don't know where to start? Want to get some practice with no risk? That is what you'll get if you participate in this competition called The Biggest Winner. It's a partnership between Horizons ETFs and National Bank, and Mark Noble will be here to talk about it. He's the Executive Vice President of ETF Strategy at Horizons, and he's going to tell us how it works. And there are so many things to consider when it comes to estate planning. One of them is trying to safeguard your inheritance. So some people are going to spend every last penny before they go. Other people know that there is going to be some left to the people they love. How do you make sure that that is the biggest number possible, taking advantage of insurance and taxes and all that stuff? Celine Hsu is Director of Wealth Products at RBC Insurance. Plus, I'll speak with Erin Lowry, author of the Broke Millennial series. She's created this cool new workbook that is designed to help you take action, get into action when it comes to your finances. We love action around here. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple, brought to you in part by Credit Canada, the first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Let's get started. Learning about investing is one thing, but actually trading investments is another, especially when it's your real own real money. So what about a way to get familiar with trading in a risk-free way? Horizons ETFs has a partnership with National Bank, and it hosts a six-week-long trading simulation, trading contest called The Biggest Winner. Mark Noble is Executive Vice President of ETF Strategy at Horizons ETFs, and he joins us now to talk about the contest and what participants will learn. Hello there.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm great. I love this idea of a simulation. I think it's cool that it focuses on ETFs because that's a way of investing that more and more Canadians can and should know more about. Let's start off with talking about the contest itself. How does it work?
Well, we've been doing this for 12 editions. So we've been doing this for quite some time. And as you highlighted, the idea behind it is to take every ETF in Canada that's listed on the Toronto Stock Exchange, and in real-time simulation, so really only a 15-minute delay from real-time market data, you can go in and build a portfolio. You start with $100,000 of fantasy funds, and you build a portfolio, and you're seeking to generate the highest return over a six-week period. Or in some cases, we actually have awards available on a weekly basis. In general, we give about $20,000 in prizes, with a grand prize winner getting about $10,000.
I remember when you could count the number of ETFs on the market on like your fingers and toes. There was I could probably have named them back in the day. How many are out there now for players to choose from?
It's fairly astounding. You're looking at over 1,000 options just in Canada alone. Yeah, it's incredible. And believe it or not, that's one of the reasons why this competition keeps getting bigger and bigger, is because the options and the types of ways to win is increasing. So when we first started the competition, we were probably at around 300 or so ETFs, and investors kind of had a pretty good sense of like the 30 or so that they could trade, most of them being leveraged. Trading is very different than investing, where they could generate high daily returns. Now with the advent of things like cryptocurrency ETFs, covered call products that have leverage on them, even single stock ETFs, which are not in this competition, but they're in the Canadian marketplace. There's just so many different ways to generate a return that you start to get a much more diversified leadership profile, which personally I think is really exciting.
I'm glad you drew the distinction here between trading, like short-term trading, and 6 weeks I'd call short-term, and investing for a year, 30 years, something like that. This competition is very clearly about the former.
Yes, there's no question. And it's really funny, even when I interview former winners and I ask them about what do you actually have your portfolio, it's a lot of S&P 500 ETFs that they're holding for 20 years, maybe a couple stocks that they like. And that same investor when we track how many trades are doing, they'll do upwards of 100 to 200 trades in this competition doing natural gas, cryptocurrency. So it really is highlighting that the mindset of a trader is one focused on risk and really trying to seek out risk, where the mind of an investor is one seeking out returns and trying to avoid risk. So it's almost completely two polar opposite of ways for which to allocate your money.
At the end of each competition, I'm sure you can discern the themes that made or broke the winner. And right. In past years, they might have been things like cannabis or alternative energy or biotech or something. What's your hypothesis on what a winning theme could be this year? What is the territory that people are most excited about playing in?
Well, right now, very different from previous years. Most years it's commodities. And I think this year we'll probably see natural gas and oil and people going long and short. Remember, at any point in the day, one's up and one's down if you're using leveraged or inverse leverage ETFs. Those are always popular. And I think those will generate a fair amount of returns. But if we had to take one asset class that's really tearing it up right now, it's artificial intelligence related equities. So in particular, semiconductors. So there are semiconductor ETFs in Canada. Our firm even has one. And that is a strategy where you don't even really need to trade it. It's just with NVIDIA and all the other semiconductor stocks hitting all-time highs, that's sort of been the brand new kind of shiny toy for investors. And it's really creating a little bit of a different trajectory and a little bit of a different leaderboard, because you've got some of these kind of commodity traders and you've got these people that are actually kind of just going long AI. And I'd say it's kind of a fight between the two right now to see which comes out on top at the end of the competition.
The contest is called The Biggest Winner, but you will also have a biggest loser in and hooray for them, because they're clearly hitting for the bleachers. In prior years, like, how off did they go? Because with short selling and those kinds of things, those losses can be off the charts.
Well, if there's a consistent biggest loser, it might be me.
Do you play along?
I do. I mean, it's fun, right? This is the fun part of investing, and it's the part, and that's why we do this competition, is we want to create a comfort level, not necessarily with trading, but with investing and investing in terms of trying to see how these ETFs work. So why not try some things you wouldn't do with your own money? And certainly I do that. And it seems like I get it wrong quite a bit. And most of the time, yeah, it's usually shorting commodities at the wrong time. Not taking into account things like, gets a little technical, but contango, which is like a premium roll that works against you in the futures market. Some of this stuff gets a little bit complex. And if you don't have the timing just right, you can get hurt. So even myself, who's been an investment professional for over 15 years, I still get absolutely hammered sometimes in this competition. So if there's biggest humbling loser, it's probably on my forehead.
Right. What are the strategies that people employ? You talked about going long, going short. Do some people just play it straight? Are there contenders who just play it straight?
Quite a few, actually. And we really love that. We have a lot of people that are brand new to ETF investing. So actually this year is our record number of registrants. And a lot of them have come from the self-directed investment community and have been driven sort of through the influencer and Reddit networks, which are more buy long and hold investors. And one stat that people don't realize is that in the self-directed community, there's actually more ETF ownership than mutual fund ownership. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these investors are new. We added 4 million new investors in Canada over the last 3 years and through the course of the pandemic. And so what we're seeing, what they're doing is they're actually using this as a way just to get comfortable with buying ETFs. So there are a lot of people actually who come into the competition and they just buy US equities, or they buy fixed income, or they buy maybe gold stocks or something that's a little bit risky for them. And it's a way for them to dip their toes in and get a sense of, you know, how do I trade an ETF? And when I say trade, how do I take into account things like bid-ask spreads and pricing versus NAV? And so we have a large proportion of investors, probably like one third or so, that are building a portfolio that they might build in real life, but they're using this as a way to sort of do their own simulation or their own trading for what they might want to do in their own portfolio.
What's your sense? I know you won't have precise data on this, but what's your sense in terms of the number of contestants who are fundamental investors and those who are technical investors? They're playing some wacky computer screen and it's like something out of a Hollywood movie.
Right now, if I look at the data, it's probably one third, one third, one third. So one third being people that are using technicals and trading patterns to grade volatility, and really what they're trying to do is find risky assets and go long or short. I'd say 1/3 are people who are buying things that interest them, but they've never wanted to try it out. Cryptocurrency is a big one, right? What's that look like if I put that in my portfolio? So those are people that would be more fundamental. And 1/3 are people that I literally think are throwing darts at the board and like, you know, like shiny tickers and are kind of just riding with it. So,
right. The, you know, Ouija it takes board all kinds. Is there. The yeah. research occurs on a Ouija board.
Throwing bones on the floor, all that kind of fun stuff. So.
There, one of the things as a part of the evolution of the ETF market here in Canada, back in the day, it was super boring and it was an index that everybody had heard of. Now right. there is an ETF for every single flavor of the month. And you see this all the time. Mm-hmm. How do you, as Horizons, balance keeping on top of trend and ensuring that you've got a product that delivers on trend, and also not getting caught in, oh, we just launched this thing that turned out to be horrible a year ago, no one wants and no one's making any money on?
Well, that's a tough question. I mean, that's the product development process in a nutshell. What we're generally trying to do is we generally try to find good investment ideas that will also be ideas that investors will gravitate towards. The challenge, of course, with the capital markets is you just don't know what's going to work. So generally speaking, and if the ETF business, in terms of successful ETFs, and these are ETFs that generate 80, you know, large amount of assets, that's less than 20% of the ETF offering. So the vast majority of ETFs in Canada are not, I would call, successful. And in fact, I would estimate that about 30% of the ETFs in Canada aren't even profitable. So a lot of ETF launches, if I'm being perfectly honest, are a little bit of a numbers game. Right. Because as you mentioned, the large asset classes are so well established. Like if there's, I think, probably over 20 S&P 500 ETFs in Canada alone. So why would you launch another S&P 500 ETF? So people will use slicing, dicing of flavors of that index, or they'll try different strategies. And sometimes it's just a case of seeing what's actually going to work. But there is a due diligence process. And that due diligence process is, of course, we have to back test and look and see whether these ETFs actually do deliver value. Because as an asset manager, despite what some people might think, we make our money from management fees, which means that as assets grow, we grow in terms of our revenue, and we want people to be successful. The challenge, of course, is that with the market changing and the dynamics of the market changing very frequently, you never know which your product is actually going to be successful from a returns perspective.
Just before we go, remind me, what's the prize? What's the prize of the biggest winner?
The biggest winner prize for the grand prize winner is $10,000. So that's real money that hopefully goes into a portfolio of their liking down the road. Yeah. But there also are weekly $500 prizes as well. So we don't just reward someone for the long term. We also are trying to highlight people that have captured the right theme in the week, and that keeps a little bit more engagement happening.
Yeah. And that's a video game where you're learning something quite helpful. I could sign up for that. So. Maybe I'll send my 13-year-old in there. Give them some more screen time if they play. Mark, thanks for your time.
No, pleasure as always.
Mark Noble, Executive Vice President of ETF Strategy at Horizons ETFs. He was here to talk about his company's partnership with National Bank. It is a trading contest, trading simulation called The Biggest Winner. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, unemployment can be really, really, really stressful for so many different reasons. And in practical terms, tough to navigate when it comes to your money. Credit Canada Counselor Randolph Taylor will be here with some tips on that topic. And later, are you losing out on opportunities for feathering the nest for your loved ones after you pass? Some people are in the circumstance in which there is money that can serve as a legacy after they are gone. How do they make the most of that? Celine Sue, Director of Wealth Products at RBC Insurance, is here to talk about some ideas there. Listen, I'm here yakking to you on SiriusXM, but I also hang out on CBC Radio every Wednesday afternoon. We talk about a personal finance story in the news, and I connect it to your everyday, real and relevant and extraordinary financial life. So tune into CBC Wednesday afternoons as well.
You're listening to Moolah La, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Welcome back. Moolah La, Money Made Simple is brought to you in part by Credit Canada. I am the CEO of the organization, and we are Canada's longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency. Our mission is to help people get out of debt so they can get back into life. Listen, debt is a brutal reality for millions of Canadians. It starts to pile on for lots and lots of different reasons: job loss, divorce, illness, bad luck, you name it. Our accredited credit counselors are available to help you understand your current financial situation and take you through all your options on how to move forward. And there really are options out there. So go to creditcanada.com. We are nonprofit. As I said, the counseling is free and judgment free. Getting laid off from a job can be brutal, brutal. There is the immediate challenge of paying expenses, right? Then there's the uncertainty about the future, plus all of the emotions coursing through your veins. So how can you best navigate this time of unemployment when it comes to your money? To help us answer this question, we're joined by Randolph Taylor, a certified credit counselor at Credit Canada. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
You have probably received, I don't know, tens, hundreds of calls from clients who have been hit with this particular circumstance. What are some of the themes? Yeah, what are some of the themes that come up for people when they call? What are they feeling? What are they dealing with?
Oh boy, there's a wide range of feelings. People are scared. There's people who have anxiety. There's even some shame. Sometimes people feel that others will judge them because they don't have a job. So there's a wide range of feelings. Scared and anxiety probably are the two biggest ones. The unknown, they don't know what's going to happen next. So that's what's causing these themes.
Having known you for as long as I have, I know that if they reach you on the phone, you are going to be kind, you are going to be empathetic, you're going to be a great listener, and you're going to provide some practical advice. So we're going to go down that path here in terms of tips for managing your finances. First among them is the unemployment benefits, getting on track for that. What do people need to do in order to ensure that that check starts coming in?
Yep. So first off, just apply. As soon as you stop working, you put your application through, try to submit your claim within 4 weeks of becoming unemployed. An important point here is that EI does not apply if you voluntarily left your job, only if you're laid off.
What kind of proof does the government require on that front? Is there some sort of a letter, or you just swear over a Bible or a bottle of whiskey?
It's usually the ROE, the record of employment from your previous employer, to fill out the required forms, and they should be able to start that process.
Next is to rethink your budget. And this is hard for people, especially if they've been living, you know, the same way for a long, long period of time and spending in the same way for a long period of time. What are some ways that people can manage fixed expenses first?
Fixed expenses, I would suggest calling around to see what options your service providers may be able to do to give you a hand during this difficult time. So whether it's a cell phone provider, an insurance provider, just reaching out to them to see what options, what supports are out there to put you in a better position to maintain the payments to them while your income is low during the period of unemployment. You know, an example of that, maybe because you're not working at this particular time, maybe you're not driving as much. So if you're able to call your car insurance company and say, hey, you know, is there any option to drop my rate while I'm at home searching for a job? That can help to save you a few dollars right there.
It's also important to prioritize essentials, you say, but difficult, I think, for all of us, regardless of circumstance, difficult sometimes to determine what is a need and what is a want. How do you make that call for yourself?
Well, it's tough. It's tough, Bruce. The first thing that I always tell my clients is, let's define exactly what a need and a want are for you. Now, by my definition, a need is something that is necessary to live and to function. A want is something that can improve your quality of life. Now, there are some people that I've spoken to that Netflix is a need, right? So it really, really just depends. There's some people who will, you know, face the time of unemployment, but maybe they have a support in place. Maybe they have their family, their friends that can give them three meals a day for a few months to help them through. So although food is in theory a need. Maybe for that particular person, they have that covered. So they may feel, hey, I'll keep Netflix on so I can keep my stress levels down. So there isn't a one size fits all. I will say just write down in your definition, what are your needs? What are your wants? Let's take a look at that and figure out what can be adjusted.
Credit card payments are critical. Some people who find themselves without a job have, you know, for their whole life paid off their credit card in full, and other people have been struggling to make ends meet for long periods of time. What do you think people should do to think through how they at least make the minimum payment on that card?
Yes. So reaching out to the credit card company that you owe to explain what's going on, bring them up to speed to see, again, what supports they may be able to provide to bring the payments down or adjust the payments to the level that you can now afford being unemployed. That'd be a good first step. If you're in the great habit of making full payments to your credit card, paying them off in full every month, maybe now that you're in a period of unemployment, maybe those payments can come down, not, you know, ever going underneath what the requirements are, but paying maybe a little bit more than what is required, but less than what you're paying before. Those things can help.
If you have student loans, you may qualify for a repayment assistance plan. How does that work?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So with the RAP or the Repayment Assistance Program, the government will pay any unpaid interest on the federal part of the student loan that your reduced payment doesn't cover. This is a great way to help a lot of folks who are in a position where they're not able to service payments for their student loans.
Hmm. Mortgage is a big, big deal for people, not only because they want to keep the roof over their head, but because that's a real high stakes debt. You don't want to fall behind on that.
Yes.
Sometimes it is possible to defer a payment. How does that conversation work?
Yes. So just reaching out. So just as we just said with the credit cards, reaching out to the mortgage company to explain what's going on. There are deferments that they may be able to help with, which, you know, can put a sort of hold or defer the payment to another month. Oftentimes, a mortgage is one of the biggest payments in a person's monthly expenses. Having that deferred to another month can help you get through and just might be that little bit that you need to find a job and get you back on track.
These questions that you're asking the credit card company, the mortgage company, the government on student loans, maybe utilities, you're calling and asking what can be done. Is there any question is there any connection between those questions and your credit score? Because further to your comment about shame, a lot of people would be terrified to pick up the phone and call their lender in case that was a hit to their score.
Bruce, there is no hit. No, having a conversation on the phone will not impact the credit rating, credit score in any way. No.
So you don't have to say, hey, I have this friend and my friend just lost their job. You don't have to say that. You can actually be transparent and talk about yourself.
That's correct, Bruce. That's right. Yes. Just be upfront. Tell them what's going on. Only missed payments or not maintaining the card, the mortgage, the obligation as agreed, can then result in the creditor, whoever that might be, reporting to the credit reporting agencies about the lack of payments or the short payments, whatever it might be, which can then impact the credit score. But making a phone call, perfectly fine.
Cash flow is made up of two things. One is the expenses, but of course the other is income. And some people think, okay, like I've been laid off from my job, but maybe there's a way that I could fill in the gap. And I know it's kind of a cliche to say, well, you could just go drive for Uber. What's your perspective on whether it makes sense for someone to pursue a gig like that?
Yes. So I think we need to look at the financial landscape of that particular individual to see if that's going to make sense or not. Like going back to the example I used earlier on, person A becomes unemployed, but they have family or friends that can help them with groceries, help them with a few things. Maybe the income that they are receiving from EI will be sufficient to service all of their living expenses. They can focus all their time and effort at getting a new job, because finding a new job can be in itself a full-time job. But on the other side, if the income that is being received on EI is not sufficient to maintain the obligations as they become due that a person might have, then yes, finding another source of income, whether that's Uber, Lyft, whatever it might be, just to get you through can be a good thing. Keeping in mind there can be some tax implications, which we won't get into now, but those are things to keep in mind as well.
The banks do have some level of discretion on the interest rate that they charge people on their debt. If you're trying to stack the deck, aiming for success for someone to advocate for themselves with a bank or a lender, what would some of the information be that they should have at the ready? How should they approach that conversation? Does charm win the day?
Charm can't hurt, but it doesn't make the decision. No. Mm-hmm. So you want to ensure that I guess you have good information on the income sources that are coming in. Keep your credit score as good as it can possibly be. Those are two main things that a bank or financial. I mean, there's other things as well, but those are two big ones that the banks will look at or take into consideration.
In the perfect world of rainbows and butterflies, someone who has been laid off, someone who is laid off will find a job in short order. And sometimes it takes a lot longer. It can take months and months and months. It could take even longer than that. At what point should people pick up the phone and call someone like yourself? They're listening to this, they've been laid off, they're in these tough circumstances. How do they know when they should say, geez, I actually need more help?
Yes. So I think the first red flag, I think, would be that maybe you're able to make payments every month. Everything is going well, but you're not seeing the balances going down. Another would be maybe you're just having difficulty maintaining the minimum payments required for the debt. Maybe you're getting calls from the creditors that you owe. If you're receiving harassing calls, these are all signs that you need to pick up the phone and give us a call. You know, even if things are going well, give us a call. We'd love to chat, but definitely in those three instances, it would be good to reach out.
Randolph, thank you so much for your insight today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Bruce.
Randolph Taylor, certified credit counselor at Credit Canada. And we were talking about how do you manage the money if you're in the unfortunate circumstance of having been laid off from your job.
Hi, it's me, your debt. Look, we need to talk. This isn't working. The missed payments, the collection calls, and all those sleepless nights. We need nonprofit debt counseling, and I found the perfect place. Credit Canada Debt Solutions. They're non-judgmental, 100% confidential. They'll negotiate with creditors and even stop interest. Don't you want to rebuild your credit? You deserve better.
Break up with debt. Visit creditcanada.com.
Stay with us. Coming up later on Moolala, your inheritance, the one you want to leave to your loved ones. How do you make the most of that if you're in a circumstance in which you believe there's going to be a legacy for you to pass on? Celine Sue from RBC Insurance will be here. But first, you've heard about the Broke Millennial books because we've talked about them here on this show before. There's now a Broke Millennial workbook, and author Aaron Lowry will be here to talk about what's inside. To stay up to date on all things Moolala, you can sign up for our newsletter. On that newsletter, you'll hear about this show on SiriusXM. You'll hear about stuff that I've done on CBC Radio or CityLine or BNN Bloomberg or wherever the heck I'm yakking about these days. Moolala.ca is the website. You can go there and sign up for that newsletter. We will do nothing with your email address other than send you that newsletter, which comes once every month or 6 weeks or so.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
There are a near infinite number of personal finance books out there. There is so much to read, all sorts of great insight. And the key thing about personal finance is you have to do something with these books. So we're bringing Erin Lowry back onto the show to talk about her new workbook. So she is the creator of the Broke Millennial series, and she's now launched this really super practical workbook that we are going to talk about today. Erin joins us from the Upper West Side in Manhattan, probably the best place on the earth except for where I live. Hello, Erin.
Hi, wonderful to be back.
Thank you for joining us again. Why did you decide that what was next was a workbook?
Well, I feel like you really nailed it there, that there's an infinite number of things we can read, and not just the books. There are the blogs, the websites, the podcasts you can listen to, the TikToks you can watch, the everything. There's so much information. And I would almost say there's too much information.
I would agree with you.
And a big part of that is that you can kind of end up in either an analysis paralysis situation, or just you continue to consume what you're supposed to do, but you don't ever pair it with action. And without putting pen to paper and actually making a plan, your financial life is never actually going to improve. So the workbook, the intent anyway, if you actually pick up the pen or pencil, whatever you prefer, is to make yourself have to create a plan for how to improve your financial life.
You have a section called how to interact with the workbooks. Okay, we need pencil, pen, writing material of some sort. Is it like we're binging Succession, or is it work on it an hour a day for a month and you go?
I don't even think you need to do an hour a day for a month. I would almost encourage it to be something you're thinking about doing over a 4 to 6 month period, because I feel like an hour a day for a month is almost, and pardon the analogy, a bit of a crash diet feeling that you're going to perhaps put yourself either into a deprivation situation, which, by the way, is never once encouraged in this book. Please do not do that. In fact, I advocate for a fun fund. You should set some money aside for a little pressure release when you are in a season of your life where maybe you're paying off a lot of debt or trying to save up a lot of money to buy a house or whatever it is. And the only big rule I would say is I want you to read the introduction, which is chapter one, and then chapters 2 and 3 chronologically, because through those, we're doing a couple of key things. One, a bit of an analysis on your emotional relationship to money, because that's going to come into play throughout the workbook. But the other big part is establishing common language so that as we continue on and I say something like debt to income ratio, you understand very well.
What is she talking about?
Exactly. Right. But after that, hop around. If you're someone who wants to do the hard stuff first, do the hard stuff first. If you're someone who wants, like, you know, a little bit of a nice appetizer that might feel a little easier, like how to set boundaries in your financial life with your friends, which might sound easy on paper, it's much harder in theory, or in practice, I should say, then hop there first.
Oh my gosh, I want to hop there right now. How do you set boundaries with your friends when it comes to money?
You need to be honest. That's first and foremost.
Okay.
For me, I would say, so the third book in the series is Broke Millennial Talks Money, which is Script Stories and Advice to Navigate Awkward Financial Conversations, a mouthful of a subtitle. Mm. But it's so important because you can do this workbook, you can do all of the things right, you can build the perfect financial life for yourself. But if you can't set a boundary with people in your life, whether that's friends, family, coworkers, other loved ones, it's so easy to let other people spend your money. Because if you're not willing to either say no or say, I would love to, but this particular thing doesn't work for me, here's another solution. It's why so many people can end up in debt over friends' bachelorette parties or, you know, feeling like we're all college buddies. Maybe you're a teacher and they work in finance and those are two very different salaries, but you're trying to play keep up with them. Or maybe it's just you have very different interests at this phase of your life. You know, they wanted to spend $500 to go to the Taylor Swift concert. And as much as you enjoy some of her albums, that wasn't necessarily a top value for you, but you still spent the money because you wanted to be part of the fun.
Right. You have a chapter called The Dreaded B Word. I'm going to assume you don't mean boundary. I'm going to assume it's a word that rhymes with smudget. Am I right?
Yes. That would be a correct assumption.
Uh-huh. So how do you think about the smudget, the budget?
I wish that everyone could reframe it in their heads to just consider that all you need to know is how much is coming in and how much is going out. And that puts you in control. Like, there doesn't need to be this whole restriction around everything, unless that's what works for you, then, you know, congrats.
Hooray.
That can be your style. But just because a particular style worked for your best friend or worked for this personal finance guru that you followed or worked for your coworker who's now evangelizing about it constantly, that's great. That doesn't mean that's what's the right fit for you. And also, as your life unfolds, your budget also needs to change as well. The budgeting style I use now at 34 is very different than the style I used when I first moved to New York City at 21. And I just want everyone to reframe it. I love the term spending plan. That's something that's become a little bit more common within personal finance. That makes it feel a little bit more fun, but also that it's just a control mechanism. It's a way to put you in control of your money, no matter how much or how little there is every month.
We call it a sustainable spending plan over here, because you want to build something that you can follow over the course of months and years and not have it be that binge and purge kind of thing. You talk about how expensive life is, and it really, really is. For those who are newer in their career, perhaps they have a really hard time balancing the today and tomorrow. What advice do you have on that? And how does it manifest in the workbook? What sort of questions? What am I putting my pencil and paper to?
Well, some of that in the beginning is thinking through things like, what would retirement look like for you? What is your dream scenario? What dream life do you want to be living in the future? And once we can really create an image for ourselves, it becomes a lot easier to invest for it. And I use that word very carefully because a lot of times we say save for retirement. I feel that that's a misnomer. You should be investing for retirement. If you want to save, great. It's just going to take a heck of a lot more money to achieve the same goal compared to actually investing your money and using, depending on where you are, vehicles like a 401k, speaking to the American audience.
Yep.
RSSP. Am I going to get that right?
RRSP. Yeah. Well done. Yes. Yes.
Close. But one, I think really thinking about future you for some people is motivational. The other big part of it is just the little incremental amounts. What I always fear happens for folks is feeling like, well, 1%, what difference does it make? It can make so much difference over years, especially when we add compound interest for one, but for two, it's more about just starting and starting with as much as you can, which might be 1%, and then increasing that by half to 1%, let's say every 3 to 6 months. And then you're slowly working your way there so that it doesn't feel like this huge pain point where all of a sudden you've gone from 0 to 10%, because you are really going to feel that in your paycheck. That very slow inching tends to work very effectively.
You mentioned your husband. I have been married for almost 23 years. It's a lifetime. How do you recommend couples work their way through this workbook? Because I can see it being a really powerful way to have a non-judgmental, I don't know, catalyst to a conversation that every couple should have.
Well, there is a whole chapter about how to have financial conversations, how to get financially naked. And in that chapter, I'd recommend you each read it separately and then come together, because there are questions that I want you to be thinking through. And I also give a bit of a playbook about how to actually handle the conversation, including please have a very strong poker face. Make sure that when you're going into this conversation, if
oh my God, I would fail at that. What are you talking about? A poker face? So I would need a ski mask. I'd need my own ski mask.
Then maybe everybody turns their back to each other for this conversation or a ski mask. That just might feel a little scarier.
Yeah.
But to make sure that you're creating a safe environment to share vulnerable things, finances can be really vulnerable, particularly if you've made a mistake. So if it's the first time you've had this conversation with your partner and you're going to share, hey, I have $7,000 in credit card debt, if your partner makes a face of any kind, really, whether it's shock, horror, you know, a grimace, whatever it is, that's going to fracture trust a little bit. You're going to feel very insecure, very self-conscious, and that can be really hard to rebuild. So please have a poker face through all of this and make sure that you're also acknowledging where debt comes from and how it came to be, as opposed to just being like, red flag, there's debt, I'm done.
Right.
That's never the answer, in my opinion.
Now, workbook connotes a learning environment. You have a chapter called, Do You Have a Gold Star in Personal Finance? A lot of your readers may think, oh my God, I'm never going to have one because I'm, you know, terrible about this, or I believe that I will always be terrible about this. How do you use the phrase a gold star?
Well, to me, a gold star really has more to do with getting the basics of your financial life under control. So you're building the emergency savings fund. You are starting to invest for retirement. It doesn't mean that you are flawless in all of these categories. Mm-hmm. You've started to build or improve your credit score if you need to, or you're protecting it if you already have a strong credit score. All of these key parts that make up our financial life, the gold star either means you've achieved it, or I would also say you're on your way to achieving it. That's something that is also incredibly important, is to monitor your progress. And that is also a huge through line of the workbook, is that instead of just fixating each month on this is where I am, oh no, because that's how a lot of us tend to feel. It's this is where I am, but look where I was 4 months ago. It's amazing that I have achieved this month in 4 months, and keep focusing on your own benchmark.
As you said, there's a part of your workbook that's linear in nature, but much of it is not. You can dip and pick and choose. I'm going to ask you a tough question. What is the single most important question that you ask in this workbook that exceeds the importance of all others that people could sort through?
How does money make you feel?
And why do you believe that's the most important? I love your answer.
I believe that's the most important because all too often we think we can just muscle through handling money because this is how you're quote unquote supposed to handle money. And we're going to get told that by countless people. If you do not know what your emotional relationship to money is, and you keep ending up in a cycle, just I'm going to use this as an example, where every month you run up your credit card a little bit and then you pay it off, then you run it up and you pay it off. And there's like a stimulus happening there. If you're not addressing your why and why you have that relationship, it's not going to get fixed. So you're just going to get trapped in this cycle. You need to understand your emotional relationship to money before you can create a system that works for you.
Taylor Swift should write a song about that very question. I think she would be so insightful and genius. Erin, thank you for your time today and congrats on this latest in the series.
Thank you so much. Wonderful to be back.
Erin Lowry is the author of The Broke Millennial Workbook. You got to check it out. It's very like do this, do that, very practical. And I think the insight is powerful. The style is engaging in and of itself, just the way that it's written. All right, stick around. Coming up, Celine Sue from RBC Insurance is going to be here to talk about the inheritance that you just might leave to your loved one. If you have missed an episode of Moolala, you can do one of two things. You can go to moolala.ca and you can search for the episode by name or by topic. You can also listen to the full episode, or you can go to any of the podcast platforms out there. So wherever you're listening to Apple Music or Spotify or Stitcher or whatever, you can get the podcast there. While you're there, you could give us a review, which would be so great, and enable other people to find the show over time.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
We talk a lot about estate planning on this show. A lot. Partly because our listeners want to hear about it, and partly because it really, really matters. And the circumstances that you can be in are just so broad and varied for people. High assets, low assets, lots of family, no family, so many different circumstances. One that we don't talk a ton about is the type of person who has money that they're not going to spend in their lifetime, that they know is going to be a legacy for the generation to come. And they want to make sure that those loved ones are getting as much of that money as possible. So that particular angle is the one that we are going to focus on today. Our guest is Celine Sue, Director of Wealth Products for RBC Insurance. She's here to talk about how to maximize, I mean, it sounds like an odd thing to say, but maximize that inheritance for those who are passing it along to. Hello, Celine.
Hi there, how are you?
You saw me hesitate over the phrase maximize your inheritance, because I think rightly there is two thoughts that run parallel in my head. On the one hand, of course, I want to maximize it and minimize the tax and all that stuff. But I also want to, I'm planning on spending every single penny of mine, till the minute before I go off into the horizon. How do you think about this idea of maximizing your inheritance, the inheritance that you leave?
Yeah. And I think, you know, a big part of estate planning is really structuring your assets and finances in such a way that's going to minimize those taxes and fees. And that, you know, in order to maximize what your loved ones receive. But I think, you know, taking it a step back a little bit, because of course we want to maximize the inheritance, but, you know, we do need to understand about what's going to happen to your assets once you pass away. And, you know, many Canadians are in the dark when it comes to what happens to their money after they pass away. In fact, we just did a survey and the survey revealed that 61% of Canadians are not familiar with the probate process.
Yeah. Well, if they listen to this, they're going to be a little bit more familiar. So can you tell us what the probate process is and maybe some things you can do to make it the least onerous process as possible for your executor and your family members?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think anybody that's gone through the probate process, it's not a pleasant experience. And, you know, when someone does pass away, their estate and their will must go through this process called probate. And I'm not going to go into too much detail, and I don't want to oversimplify it either, but it's basically that legal process that your assets and your will needs to go through in order to distribute your assets once you've passed away. And this process can be very costly, very time consuming. Some estates can settle very quickly, but some can take months or even years to settle. But I think the fact is that every will has to go through this probate process. So you really want to be prepared. And I think more importantly, you want to prepare your loved ones so that they aren't having to pay for any fees, any of the taxes, or any out-of-pocket expenses that will start to accumulate after you pass away.
And how do you do that? How do you prepare them?
Yeah, and this is kind of where insurance products can come into play. Products such as segregated funds can help to grow and protect your money, but they can also play a really important role in your estate plan and can be used as a strategy to minimize those fees and taxes that we were talking about when you're planning your estate. So seg funds, because they're insurance products, they bypass probate, they bypass your will. So you're not having to pay for those fees that come with probate. So there's an element of cost savings there. You know, with your assets going through your will, those costs could amount to upwards of 10% of your estate. But any money that's put in a seg fund product, which is very similar to mutual funds, but they offer very many unique benefits because they're insurance products, they will save you from a lot of those probate costs, executor costs, legal costs, and leave. That means that, you know, more money is left in your loved one's hands.
And they're an insurance product, but they're not insurance.
Exactly. They're a hybrid. I would say, you know, they are insurance, but they're also investment products. So very similar to mutual funds that help you grow and protect your assets, but they have estate planning benefits that come along with them.
Tell me more about that. Because when I think of insurance, I think I'm protecting myself from calamity. If I die and my wealth is in a seg fund, it's not like they get the equivalent of a term life payout because I've got a seg fund.
Exactly. I love the way you position that, because I often use that as an example. You know, you think of insurance, you think of life insurance to protect your life. You think of health insurance, you know, critical disability to protect your health. And you have home and auto insurance to protect your home and your car. So seg funds is insurance for your money. And so it's a way to think of, you know, when you pass away, those assets in a seg fund will bypass probate. And the way that seg funds work is that they offer something called a death benefit guarantee. And again, don't want to get into too many details, but basically what the death benefit guarantee is, it's insurance on your money. So it basically guarantees that your beneficiaries will get no less than what you deposited into that investment. So if markets go up, your beneficiaries will get to enjoy all of the positive markets and the market movement. But if the markets go down, you have the peace of mind knowing that they will never get less than what you put in. So it's really protection.
And the trade-off, for lack of a better word, is that typically seg funds have a higher management expense ratio than if you were just to buy either a regular mutual fund with the same stocks in it or an exchange-traded fund. And they're higher because of that insurance protection. Have I simplified that sufficiently?
Yeah. There is an additional insurance fee. But you know, it could range from, you know, 10 basis points to 100 basis points. Again, it's not, I don't want to say that it's much more expensive than a mutual fund. They could be very comparable in price at some points.
Now, so seg funds is one thing that you would think about as a part of your estate plan. What else would you think about when it comes to insurance?
You know, you want to talk about, you know, life insurance, of course. We, you know, you mentioned that before. And also there are products called payout annuities as well that you might want to think about as an estate plan or part of your retirement plan. And these are products that will provide a guaranteed income for life. So these are products that if you do not have a pension plan at work is something that you may want to consider. So basically what you would do is you would invest a lump sum with the insurance company, and in turn, the insurance company will provide you with an income for life, so that, you know, you don't have to worry about depleting all of your savings if, you know, it's really to manage that longevity risk.
Yeah.
In case everybody wants to live too long, but you
sure.
know.
Yeah. It's funny because I am of the temperament that really, truly, I believe I'm going to not live forever, but I'm going to like tap out at 100, right? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. And the mortality tables would say I'm wrong. Like there's a chance I will, but not likely. How do you, as marketers of those products, address the temperament and then the practicality for people when they think about annuities?
Yeah. And that's really it. You know, how we position annuities is that, you know, you're not going to put all your eggs in one basket. You're not going to put all of your savings into an annuity, but you want to diversify across product types. So you want to have part of your savings put into something that's going to offer you a guaranteed income for life. And, you know, if you have a pension plan, a defined benefit pension plan with your employer, you may want to increase or supplement that with a payout annuity. So that's the way we position it here is that, you know, calculate the expenses that you may have in your retirement and purchase an annuity that will provide you with that income so that at least you know that things like your mortgage, your utility bills, medication, gas, groceries, you know that if you live, you know, dipping into your other savings to pay for those.
I want to ask a question that we talk about all the time when we talk about estate planning, and that is, how do we ensure that these conversations occur in between family members and friends often, and how do we ensure that they include the topics, the things that need to be spoken about to make life easier, both emotionally and practically for everyone?
Yeah, you bring up an excellent point. You know, I think these conversations are not happening enough. But I also understand that money and end of life discussions are very difficult for people. And these conversations can feel very uncomfortable. I mean, you know, nobody wants to talk about death. No one wants to think about their own mortality. So it's really, how can we reframe the conversation so it's not so difficult? And, you know, based on personal experience, I can offer up a few tips. My parents are very, very open with their estate plan with us. You know, they've already decided where they want to be buried. They've paid for that already. And my parents, they revisited their will not too long ago to add some more grandchildren. And, you know, we discussed the details of their will with my brothers and I. And my brothers and I left with a better understanding. It was a difficult conversation, but we left with a better understanding of what they want. And I think that was my parents' main objective, was really to ensure that we as their children are not burdened by any aspects at that time once they pass away. They want to make sure that, you know, there's no added burden on us because we're going to be already going through an emotional time. We don't need the added stress, the added grief of what this could, you know, what decisions we may have to make if they hadn't made them. So, you know, if you haven't discussed your estate plan, I would, you know, offer up a couple of tips potentially. Number one, think about how you want to bring it up, where you want to bring it up, with who you want to bring it up with. Make sure that everybody knows what's on the agenda. So make sure there's no surprises. You know, my parents always call a family meeting and we know, you know, it's something that they want to talk about with us. And above all else, be sympathetic and empathetic because you may be ready to discuss your state, but your loved ones may not be.
Are there snacks at your family meeting?
There's always snacks.
Are there always? Because that'd be my big thing. It'd be like, okay, family meeting, whatever. But what are we eating?
Yes. Oh, always homemade food. For sure.
Fantastic. See, that's the vested interest. More people should promise snacks. And yeah. then people would have the conversation. It wouldn't be so threatening. There'd be snacks.
There you go.
Celine, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Celine Sue is with RBC Insurance, and she was here to talk about estate planning, but in particular, the inheritance piece for those who are going to plan on leaving something for this next generation. That is our show for today. Thank you to our sponsors, Credit Canada, first and longest standing nonprofit credit counseling agency in the country. Here's a note on how to reach us for any comments, questions, story ideas that you may have. Our email address is ask@moolala.ca. ask@moolala.ca. You can subscribe to our newsletter at moolala.ca. You can subscribe to the podcast anywhere you listen to them on any of those platforms. You just click on the podcast and subscribe, and then my shining smile will appear in your podcast app the next time you open it up. I don't know if that maybe not a selling feature, maybe not. On social media, I am at Bruce Celery on Twitter, Bruce Celery Moolala on Facebook. I know I should be on TikTok. I'm sorry, I'm not there yet. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.